Now let's turn to Matthew chapter 20, where we stopped last hour. And we concluded with Matthew chapter 20 and verse 28, a very critical and important verse that we want to develop a little bit further this morning, because it is the first time where, in a very clear way, the Lord expresses not only the fact that He's going to die, but He is told how He is going to die, and now He is telling us in verse 28, or telling the disciples, what His death will accomplish. And so we have verse 28, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give His life a ransom for many. And therefore you have an emphasis introduced on the meaning of the death of Christ. The meaning of Christ's death. Now it is true that the meaning of Christ's death can be viewed from different angles. In 1 Peter, he takes the death of Christ and he addresses Christians and says that His steps are an example in which we should walk. However, it is totally inadequate if we would say the meaning of Christ's death is an example. That is not the core meaning. Christ's death as an example is a spin-off of the basic meaning of the death of Christ. And there is one single word that ought to be in our minds when we talk about the death of Christ. The death of Christ was a substitutionary death. Substitution is the idea. In the sense that He died in place of the sinner. He took the guilt that belonged to somebody else. He took the penalty that belonged to somebody else. Now let's see if we can sketch out a little bit about what does the Bible teach about the substitutionary death of Christ. And we'll make, first of all, a point of introduction, and it is simply this. God is just. Therefore, in the light of His justice, the sinner must be punished. God is just, therefore the sinner must be punished. Now when you look at that truth, you also are looking at a terribly bleak, hopeless situation. If God is just, I am a sinner, and since He is just, I, the sinner, must be punished. And that, of course, if we admit two things, one, that God is just, and two, that I am the sinner that is involved, then we have nothing left except punishment. It is the bleakest possible situation that you could possibly look at. However, we do have a means whereby the punishment of the sinner may fall on another. Punishment may fall on other than the sinner. That is the best possible news. Our first point is the worst possible news. It's bleak. The second point is the hope involved in it. So that when we talk about Christ's death as a substitution, we're saying two things. Christ's death is a substitution, and therefore you have described two things. You have described its nature, and you have described God's method of saving man. You've described the nature of His death. You've described also the method whereby this came about. And let's use the simplest possible illustration. And these things will all be coming to in the following studies in the book of Matthew. But go, if you will, to Mark 15. This, I think, most vividly describes what substitution means. Mark 15. As we proceed on toward the trials and the death of Christ, Mark 15 and verse 7, upon the occasion of the death of Christ, it says, the man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionist who had committed murder in the insurrection. And the multitude went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. And Pilate answered them, saying, do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews? For he was aware that the chief priests had delivered him up because of envy. But the chief priests stirred up the multitude to ask him to release Barabbas for them instead. And the interesting thing within the context is Barabbas was clearly guilty, clearly condemned, and his cross was there. Barabbas, the condemned, guilty man, never saw his cross because Christ took his cross. That is called substitution. It was the fact that the cross that belonged rightly and justly to Barabbas was instead borne by the person of Christ. Now, let's take this doctrine of substitution and notice the way that God teaches it. First of all, the idea of substitution in the Old Testament. And for that, let's go to the book of Leviticus, chapter 1. And notice how the beginning teaching revolves about substitution. Leviticus chapter 1. And basically, substitution in the Old Testament was taught by means of the sacrifices. The way God got it across in the Old Testament. And when you sinned and became guilty and thus worthy of death, you could bring a sacrifice, beginning in Leviticus chapter 1 and verse 2. Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering, and the word offering is interesting. It's a word that literally in Hebrew means coming near. It was a way of approach. So if any of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of animals from the herd or the flock. So the first thing you did was you select on the basis of a divinely given criteria. You selected an animal on the basis of divinely given criteria. Verse 3, if the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it a male without defect. He shall offer it at the doorway. So notice that the kind of animal, the quality of the animal, the place of the sacrifice was all criteria. God told how it was to be done. So the first thing you did was to select the right sacrifice, the right way of approach to God. And that is going to be critical because man throughout his history is going to come up with all kinds of ideas on how he thinks he may approach God. And right back in the book of Leviticus, God is saying, let me give you a checklist. It must be from the herd. It must be a male. It must be without defect. And let me tell you, you don't do it in your house. You do it at the doorway. In other words, it's all specified, and therefore you select what the means of approach is based on divine criteria. That obviously holds true today. Jesus was very, very clear and emphatic in saying that the selection of your way to God is very narrow because he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody comes to the Father except by me. And therefore, the first step then was a selected sacrifice. The second step is down at verse 4. He, that is the sinner, shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering. First, selection. Second, identification. And that, of course, was done. Identification with the sacrifice. See, it was not an impersonal thing. You've got the right offering, and you are identified with the right offering. The hand is placed on the head. But there's one other lesson that needs to be taught, and we can look at it from the perspective of the book of Romans and see this all clearly, but We know that not only must we come to the right person for salvation, not only but must we be identified with him, but we must recognize that we, in effect, are the cause of his death. It was our sin that caused it. And so notice in verse 4, 5 rather, he lays his hand on the head of the offering, and if you come down to verse 9, rather. No, not verse 9. Yeah, verse 9. Now we're into the action of the priest. I'm sorry. There's no verse here. Okay, 4. No? 5. Try 5. Okay, we'll get there. Verse 5, it says, he, now that's the offerer, not the priest, he shall slay the young bull before the Lord. So the third step is he must slay the animal. And that, in very vivid terms, would be saying this animal sacrifice was put to death by me. And the reason the animal was put to death by me is because I sinned and thus caused his death. And therefore you have, in a microcosm, the gospel, do you not? Why did Christ die on the cross? Because of my sin. He is God's selected one that can make salvation, and in terms of appropriating his death, I must lay, so to speak, my hand on his head. I must be identified with him. Now, what is the purpose of all of this? The purpose is back to Leviticus 1:4. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, that it, the offering, may be accepted for him. What's that saying? Substitution. Accepted for him to make atonement, and what do the next three words say? On his behalf. And so you've got a double emphasis. Accepted for him is substitution. On his behalf is substitution. And thus, teaching in the Old Testament concerning the substitutionary work of the death of Christ. So it is taught by sacrifices. Not only is substitution taught by sacrifices, it is also taught directly. And the direct teaching would come over to the book of Isaiah that really specializes in that. And if you'll go to Isaiah 40, this is going to spell out the working of events that we're going to see in the book of Matthew in the following studies as the king of Israel is rejected and his death becomes a sacrifice for the sins of men. Now, if you will take Isaiah 40 through the end of Isaiah chapter 66, and if you don't mind, get a hand in both passages, Isaiah 40 through 66. And in looking at those chapters of 40 through 66, you have what can easily be said the messianic heart of the Old Testament. While much of the Old Testament predicts the coming of the Messiah, this is the very heart of the whole thing in chapters 40 through 66. Sometimes it gets called the Little New Testament. And the reason it is often called the Little New Testament is that it begins and ends the same place the New Testament begins. The New Testament begins with the appearance of John the Baptist saying, "Behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world." You proceed through the New Testament until you get to the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation ends with the new heavens and the new earth. Well, the reason for calling Isaiah 40 through 66 not only the messianic heart of the Old Testament, but also calling it the Little New Testament is if you look at chapter 40 and verse 3, you have the prophecy of the coming of John. It says, "A voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God." And that was the message of John the Baptist. Then you proceed, and about midway you get to chapter 53, where you have the death of Christ, and you come over to chapter 66, and when you end in about verse 22, 66:22, you have the words, "For just as the new heavens and the new earth which I make will endure before me, declares the Lord, so your offspring and your name will endure. And you have the end with the new heavens and the new earth. So where Matthew and the New Testament begins is where Isaiah 40 begins, and where the book of Revelation ends is where Isaiah 66 ends. Now, go over to chapter 53, and you have your most direct teaching anywhere in the Old Testament concerning the subject of the substitutionary death of Christ. And basically, it will break into two parts. It will begin with a summary. And it's really too bad that our chapter gets divided the way it should, the way it is, rather, because it doesn't really reflect the structure. Isaiah 52, verses 13 through 15, are the summary of Christ's work. Chapter 53 are the details of Christ's work, beginning with the summary. Really, what we'll look at is the summary, 52, 13 through 15, the facts, 53, 1 through 9, and the result, 53, 10. So, summary, last three verses of chapter 52, the details of what happened down through verse 9 of chapter 53, and what was the result of this whole thing? Chapter 53, verse 10, but Yahweh was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he shall see his offspring, prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. So really, as we come to the book of Matthew, and we'll see all kinds of unjust, underhanded conniving on the part of the scribes and the Pharisees, we still must caption all of this as he is unjustly brought before Herod, as he is spit on, as his beard is pulled out, as the crown of thorns is placed on his head, the following words, the good pleasure of the Lord is prospering in his hand. So we need to have this truth in order to guide us through what is going to come forth in the following sections. And basically, whether or not you are a Christian, and whether or not you make heaven depends on one thing. God looked at the death of his son and said, that is enough, I'm satisfied. And our salvation basically depends on, are you satisfied too with the death of Christ? And that's what it means to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. We look at him the same way that God the Father looked at him, take his viewpoint, and we have salvation. All right, let's take a look at the summary, chapter 52, verse 13. Now, while the first word of verse 13 may be inane and harmless to us, in fact it is, if someone walks up to you and says, behold, I don't know, maybe it's just my feeling for that word, but that word sounds soft and fluffy, like a little pillow, behold. It's a word that, frankly, I think a lot of men probably wouldn't want to use to say, behold my wife. No, no. The word is a real zinger in Hebrew. It is an attention getter. It is used to get your attention focused on something important. It's designed to wake everybody up. Perhaps closer to it would be, now look at this, is the emphasis on it. Whatever you need there to say, wake up, don't miss this. By going on a ski trip, I'm kidding, had to do that. Don't miss this. I would be there too, but I'm a coward. I think the skiing coming down would be fine, but when we visited Colorado in the summer, there's one thing that I can't do. I did it once, and it's horrible. Right up the ski lift, I just dangling there. That thing's got to break someday. And Consequently, it's not the skiing, it's getting up the lift, riding the lift. And if you're that bad off, you shouldn't, I would think, even bother with it. Okay, so the summary begins with an intention getter in the word behold in verse 13. Behold, my servant. Now, the obvious question involved would be, who is my servant? If you were in a synagogue today, how would my servant be interpreted? The suffering servant would be interpreted by and large by Judaism as Israel. And therefore the prophet is saying, behold, my servant, that is the nation of Israel, will prosper. Well, having a New Testament, we cannot take it that way. If you go to Acts chapter 8, and Acts chapter 8 makes it extremely clear exactly who is being referred to. Acts 8. Philip is approaching the Ethiopian, and in verse 26 it says, an angel of the Lord spoke to Philip, saying, arise and go south to the road that descends from Jerusalem to Gaza. This is a desert road. And he arose and went, and behold, there was an Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, who was in charge of all her treasure. And he had come to Jerusalem to worship. And he was returning, sitting in his chariot, and was reading the prophet Isaiah. And we'll find out he was reading exactly where we are in Isaiah 52 and 53. He was reading the prophet Isaiah, and the Spirit said to Philip, go up and join this chariot. And when Philip had run up, he heard him reading Isaiah the prophet and said, do you understand what you're reading? And he said, well, how could I? And we'll want to note, where did he get stuck? What was his hang-up? What is it he doesn't understand? He says, how could I, unless someone guides me? And he invited Philip to come up and sit with him. Now, the passage of Scripture which he was reading was this, and it comes right straight out of Isaiah 53. He was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent. And by the way, the he was led, you take it back there, the he goes right back to my servant. It's my servant that's referred to in chapter 52, and then thereafter referred to as he and him. So, he, that is my servant, was led as a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before his shearers is silent. So he, that is the servant of the passage, does not open his mouth. In humiliation his judgment was taken away. Who shall retaliate, relate his generation, for his life is removed from the earth? And the eunuch answered Philip and said, please tell me, of whom does this prophet say this? Who is the identity of the him, of the he, of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53? Is he speaking of himself or of someone else? Verse 35, and Philip opened his mouth, and beginning from this scripture in Isaiah, he preached Jesus to him. So we should have no hesitation in the light of New Testament interpretation to go back then to Isaiah 52 and verse 13, when he says, behold, my servant. My servant is a reference to Jesus. My servant, Jesus, the Messiah, will prosper. And then it gives prophecy about him. And from that context, the word servant is picked up in verse 15 with the word pronoun he. Verse 2 of chapter 53, he grew up. Verse 3, he was despised. Verse 4, surely our griefs he himself bore. So it all goes back to the antecedent, the pronouns all go back to their antecedent in the noun servant in chapter 52 and verse 13. So he's speaking of the Messiah. Now, in summary, you have a triple description of his work. Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be successful. Now, why do you think that the first thing that Isaiah puts before he goes to any of the suffering of the Messiah and gives any details about that, why do you think that the first item that would appear that he wants to get our attention to is the fact that he is successful? Well, let's suppose we would write a book, and in the book we would say, we are going to give you a success story. and you turn on the inside and find that the person who was successful came, presented his ministry, was officially rejected by the entire nation in such a forceful way that they couldn't stand to have him around, and they put him on a cross and killed him. Success. Well, that gives the answer to why Isaiah puts this first. From the human standpoint, when you look at the suffering that is going to follow, you would never call that success. Well, reading chapter 53, verse 2. And try to read this all under the heading now of this is success. He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty. Success. That we should look upon him, nor appearance that we would be attracted to him. Simply saying, he was not a dynamic, attractive personality. It wasn't there. He was despised. Success. Forsaken of men. Success. Man of sorrows. Success. Acquainted with grief. Success. And like one whom men hide their face. Success. He was despised. Success. And so Isaiah very skillfully says that whatever you see from the human standpoint may spell out failure, but don't you believe it. He is the only totally successful man ever to live. And thus, when we look at the value of the cross and recognize that the only reason we will ever see heaven and the presence of God is because of that man's work, I would say he is successful. And Isaiah says that's the first thing we ought to note, Isaiah 52, verse 13, and it gives us a balance for the rest of the context, this totally successful work of this particular man. All right, next, second line of verse 13, he will be high, he will be lifted up, he will be greatly exalted. He will be successful, and second, he will be honored. And the honoring of this person is given in three verbs. And the three verbs give stages of honor. First, he will be high, lifted up, greatly exalted. And the words that come across are, first of all, the word exalted. I'll put them in order. He will be exalted. He will be lifted up. And then finally, he will be high. The word exalted is a word which you translate, if you translate literally in the Hebrew, it's a word that says he will rise. He will rise, reference to his resurrection. The word lifted up is literally an action that he takes on his own behalf. He will be raised up, pointing to his ascension. And when he ascended, we are told that he was seated on the Father's right hand, and we often call that his session. The word be high in Hebrew is what is called a stative verb. Stative verbs refer to, as you could probably guess, states or conditions. So the final condition ends up with a stative verb. He will be seated, or this is often called his session at the Father's right hand. And all of them involve the exaltation of this person. He is successful, we'll raise him, we'll ascend him, and we'll seat him, ending with the stative verb on the right hand of the Father. Now, in the midst of all of this, we need to note one other thing. Even though he is successful and honored, men will look at him and he will cause horror as he is observed in his work. Cause horror as he observed in his work. Coming down to verse 14, you have the thing that produces the horror. Verse 14 says, just as many as were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred, more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. And that is picturing the fact that he will hardly be observable as a human being. And the central part revolves about his appearance or his face. Now, how can we explain that? Well, keeping your finger in this context, go to two passages that will easily explain it. Matthew 26. We'll confine ourselves to Matthew because that's the book we're in. Formal rejection having occurred, you have narrated some of the suffering of Christ, and you began to see some of the disfigurement. Verse 67 says, they spat in his face and beat him with their fists. One of the interesting things about the crucifixion is made by a historian about, well, it's not a historian, an observation recorded by a historian, that about 30 years after the death of Christ, one of the Roman emperors made a note of how many sacrifices were made at Passover. And he comes up with the amount. And then it was customary, he notes, that you would have one sacrifice for about 10 Jews. Based on those figures, then, you come up with about 6 million people would have been crowded into Jerusalem at the time of the crucifixion. So we shouldn't have in our minds that the crucifixion of Christ, a city of Jerusalem with a few people sitting about the cross, we have a teeming city. Forget the 6 million. Make it 1 million. And in the city of Jerusalem, you have masses. And of course, these masses have been incited to scream out for his crucifixion and so forth. And here you have the people slapping his face, which would, again, repeatedly be done. You go over to chapter 27 and verse 30. And not only did they hit him in the face with the hand, but they also did it with sticks or reeds. So verse 30 says they spat on him and took the reed and began to beat him on the head. Now, it wouldn't take much of that to have a horribly disfigured type thing. And therefore, Isaiah is simply saying, man is going to look at the cross and it is going to be a horrifying sight. And the horrifying sight is going to be, look at the man in his physical condition. Of course, you have to add to that the fact that he was scourged by the Romans. The least that a scourge could be would be a leather whip, prisoner arms pulled taut, and then the leather whip across the back. That was fairly uncommon. Normally, the whip would have embedded in it either metal or glass. And the point was, so the whip would not only hit, but it would also tear flesh. And we have the recording that he was scourged by the Romans, and therefore you have the back of Christ, obviously a torn, bleeding mass. And Isaiah simply describes it in simply saying, men will be astonished or horrified as they look upon his suffering. Now, in that suffering, bleeding condition, what is happening? What is the work that is going on? Well, look down to Isaiah 52 and verse 15. What is he doing in this condition? And the key word is thus, or so. Perhaps you've got it in your translation. And the word thus points backwards. He says, thus, in the aforementioned condition. So, thus, in the condition of verse 14, the bleeding mass of humanity, he will, in one word, describes his work, sprinkle many nations. Keeping your finger here, go to Leviticus 4. One of the ministries of the priest was to do the same thing that Isaiah 53 verse 15 tells us the Messiah, the suffering one, was doing on the cross. Verse 6, the priest, and again notice who is doing it, the priest, the go-between, God and man, shall dip his finger in the blood, and the same verb shall sprinkle some of the blood seven times before the Lord in the front of the veil of the sanctuary. And so the idea involved is the priest sprinkled blood in the making of sacrifice. And I take it we can go back then, and certainly in the light of the rest of the New Testament, what is he doing in this condition? He's acting as priest. He's the go-between. He's sprinkling many nations. He is providing universal salvation for men. Kings shall shut their mouths on sight of him. What has not been told them, they will see, and that what they will not hear, they will understand. And we move from that summary statement to Isaiah 53. And in Isaiah 53, we will have a statement of the facts of his work. We will have the facts of his work in 53, 1 through 9, and then we will have the fruit of his work, 53, 10 through 12. We're getting the prophetic interpretation of what we're ready to enter into in the book of Matthew and what we are going to be seeing within 6 days of our study in Matthew chapter 21. We're ready to back off to the event of him coming into Jerusalem and the events of the final week. But we're now getting the interpretation of what is all of this about in terms of prophetic form. And it will be very fascinating to see how accurate Isaiah is in terms of what the Messiah is going to do. Now, notice as he describes the facts of his work, we begin with his life. Isaiah 53, verses 2 and 3. He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty. Verse 3, he was despised, he was forsaken of men, and so forth. So his life is in verses 2 and 3. Then you come down to verse 7, and notice I am skipping something, but for a reason. Verse 7, he was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth, is pointing to his trials. These trials are expressed as being oppressed and being afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. And one of the notable things about the suffering of Jesus is the fact that he was asked and he did not open his mouth before his trials. 53, verse 7, talks about his trials. Verse 8, by oppression and judgment he was taken away, and for his generation, who considered it, that he was cut off out of the land of the living. His death. 53, 8. And then finally, in verse 9, his grave was assigned to be with wicked men, yet with a rich man in his death. And if you have questions about the details of biblical prophecy, how does this verse 9 all work out? He was assigned by the Romans to be buried with who? Two criminals on the right and left. His grave was assigned to be with wicked men. But where did he end up? He ended up in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, who was a rich man, in his grave that had never been used. And therefore, verse 9b, yet with a rich man in his death. And so you have precise prophecy, his death, and then you have in verse 9 his burial. 53:9. Now, notice in that little outline, there is a significant omission. I said nothing about verses 4 through 6. Now, the reason for that is this. Verses 4 through 6 answers a question. What does all of this mean? Now, in order to get our attention once again, verse 4 of Isaiah 53 begins with what is called in Hebrew an affirmative particle. Affirmative particle is not given for translation purposes. It's given as a flag or a sign. Hebrew often will use, let me give you an example. If we would have in English, hit, the verb, the direct object, him. Remember doing that in school? On diagram. left side is the subject, followed by the active verb, and then followed by the direct object. And we would simply say he hit him, and we recognize that him is a direct object because him is in the objective, accusative, objective in English. Objective case in English, not accusative. Make sense. Okay, objective case in English. And consequently, we have different forms of he is a subject because that's a subjective form. And you wouldn't say he hit he because he is a subjective, not objective case at any rate. Hebrew will use signs for direct object. And in Hebrew, would read something like he hit. And then they'd put an arrow in there. Don't translate it. It's just an arrow saying, be sure you understand the word next word, him, is a direct object. And that's because they don't have as sophisticated cases and so forth like we do in in English. And therefore, there would be simply a sign word. Well, verse 4 starts with one of those words that is given in order to say, I want you to be sure to understand that what follows is true. I'm being emphatic, I'm being clear. So, by all means, our griefs, he himself bore. Notice, and our New American has made an effort to get this across. Notice the words he and himself are side by side. They could have said, surely our griefs, he bore. But in the Hebrew, the word he and, it doesn't bring it across. The word our and the word he are in juxtaposition. In other words, it looks like griefs, our, he, bore. And the word our and he is in juxtaposition. They're right next to one another in the Hebrew text. And the emphasis is he's trying to get across what? Substitution. And read it all the way through verses 4. Surely our griefs he bore. What was ours became his. And our sorrows he carried. What was ours became him. Yet we ourselves esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. What belonged to us became his. He was crushed for our iniquities. The iniquity that was ours became his. The chastening that procures our well-being fell upon him. The chastening that belonged to me was upon him. And by his scourging, we are healed. Notice, substitution is all the way through the verse. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. And the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all, literally, to meet. To encounter is the way you've got it in your margin of your New American Standard. To fall on him. Substitution all the way through. Now, we'll pick up with that and do a little more detail in our next study, but notice the emphasis is the substitutionary work of Christ. And how was that expressed for the first time in the book of Matthew? The Son of Man came not to serve, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Substitutionary death of Christ is the theme. Our Father, we're thankful today that our guilt has been taken, our punishment has been received, and therefore we can be free of penalty and of guilt. Not because we're guiltless, but because your Son, Jesus Christ, was our substitute. And we would ask that as we now approach the final week in the life of Christ, that we will see the infinite value of his work, and that apart from his redemption, we have no hope. And apart from his person, we have no salvation. In his name, amen.